Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Coming up on tonight's programme, we'll hear what's called the eye of Monocle's fashion editor, Takaharu Sato, at Copenhagen Fashion Week. We'll also hear about Qatar Airways' new exclusive lounge at London's Heathrow and discussing the future of the airport experience with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. And we'll be out in the neighbourhood meeting the local bespoke shoemakers, James Taylor and Son.
We now have a very clever 3D scanning system installed in the shop, which allows us to capture the foot really accurately, and we design our shoe lasts digitally.
Plus, are French children better behaved? We'll be learning more about the Parisian parenting style with author Pamela Druckerman. And we'll meet the man who thinks meat eaters should need a license to kill. That's right here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. All that to come, but first let's get the latest news from around the world with Louise Banbury.
Monocle 24 News with Louise Banbury. Four people were killed in Egypt on a second day of clashes triggered by the deaths of 74 people in the country's worst soccer disaster on Wednesday. In several flashpoints throughout the capital, Cairo, protesters fought street battles with police. A demonstrator and an army officer were reported dead in Cairo, and two people were killed in the city of Suez. Thousands also turned out to the streets of Alexandria, the second biggest city in Egypt. Many people blame the deaths at Portside Football Stadium on the authorities for failing to protect fans. Iran's supreme leader says the Islamic Republic won't yield to international pressure to abandon its nuclear program. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has also hinted at retaliation for sanctions aimed at Iran's oil exports, saying that attacking Iran would harm America. Malaria kills more than 1.2 million people worldwide a year, nearly twice as many as previously thought, according to new research published today. Past studies had overlooked hundreds of thousands of deaths because they had wrongly assumed malaria overwhelmingly killed babies and focused their findings on the under fives. The new study, published in The Lancet, found 42% of deaths were actually among older children and adults. Hungarian flag carrier Malev ceased operating early today after its planes were held overseas for unpaid debts. Several budget carriers, including Ireland's Ryanair and Air Berlin, announced an increase in their flights from Budapest Airport. State-controlled Malev provided 40% of revenue at the airport. Spokesman Mihaly Hardy said the airport would have to revise its business plans unless a Budapest-based airline filled the gap.
Otherwise, there has been some comments from the government side, the ministry, is saying that they still hope that an airline, maybe it wouldn't be called Malév, but a Budapest-based airline is an absolute must for Hungary, and there will be someone flying in the future.
Japan's Panasonic Corp warned of a record annual loss, joining rivals Sony and Sharp in a sea of red ink as they struggle to fix their TV businesses. Panasonic forecast a loss of 780 billion yen, that's 7.75 billion euros, for the year to March, and said it's almost all due to restructuring charges and write-downs for its Sanyo Electric unit. Nepal's Maoist former rebels shed their camouflage uniforms today and began leaving their camps to join their families in a first step to their reintegration 5 years after the end of a civil war. The rehabilitation of more than 19,000 former rebels is seen as crucial for the stability of the nascent Himalayan Republic. The Maoists led an armed revolt for the abolition of the monarchy, but are now part of Nepal's political mainstream. A senior Maoist leader was elected prime minister in August last year. Special committee coordinator Balananda Sharma said he was pleased with the latest development.
I feel very happy that the process has begun. I sincerely hope that we'll continue to progress in a positive way and resolve the entire peace process.
And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Louise. And now with a look at the global weather, here's Thomas Schaffanecker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
Another freezing cold, icy and snowy weekend for many regions of Europe, record-breaking for many countries because it's being felt so far south across the continent. Even the Mediterranean islands like Corsica and Sardinia will have nighttime frosts and possibly snow. A very snowy weekend for Eastern Europe and the Balkans. Winter weather heading for the UK too, and delays at British airports are possible. Here's the weekend city outlook. London, 0 degrees, a mix of snow, ice and rain. Paris, -1 and snow. Rome, around 1 degree and snow. In Zagreb, -9 with snow. North America and the sunny end to the working week across much of the eastern states and many major cities across Canada. The good weather will last into Saturday. Meanwhile, blizzards are impacting Colorado and Nebraska. This will continue into Saturday. In Denver, it may snow heavily most of the weekend. Is your weekend city outlook then? In Washington, 8 Celsius, a mix of sun and rain. Chicago, 4 degrees, sunshine and wintry showers. In Miami, 27 and sunny. And in San Francisco, 18 degrees with some blue skies. On to other world centres the next few days. In Japan, cold, crisp and often sunny. Just a few snow flurries in the north for Hokkaido and Honshu. In Tokyo, milder, 8 degrees with some sunshine. In China, if you're in Hong Kong, often cloudy here in the coming days and around 18 degrees. But for Singapore, it's in the tropics. It's tropical and 30 degrees. That's all. Enjoy the weekend. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafanaka here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomasz. It's 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 Tagatia. Yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e Yokoso.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala version.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, Copenhagen Fashion Week kicked off on Wednesday. It's the most important fashion event in all of the Nordic countries. So, of course, we dispatched Monocle's fashion editor, Takaharu Sato. And he joins us now on the line to discuss what new and up-and-coming labels have caught his eye at the trade fairs. Welcome, Take.
Hello, live from Copenhagen.
Thank you for joining us. Now, firstly, tell us what Copenhagen Fashion Week is like. And firstly, who goes?
It catches lots of attention from Scandinavia mainly. Of course, Denmark, people from Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, lots of buyers attending. Also Germany, the Netherlands, UK is one of the best markets for the Scandinavian fashion. And this time I was talking to one of the guys who launched a label called the Royal Republic. He's based in Amsterdam. And he's co-working with the Danish embassy in Japan to be able to invite a bunch of Japanese buyers and the people from United Arrows, Tomorrowland, and the bakers. They all attended this time. So it's getting lots of attention from Japan as well.
How important is it in setting the ball rolling for the year ahead for the industry?
It is actually important in the Scandinavian market because lots of young creative people launching the label with, of course, a little investment. So in comparison to Paris or Milan, you know, lots of like small labels are getting together, especially at the trade show called the Gallery, which is one of my actually like favorite trade shows in Europe. They get together within 3 days and having almost like over 20,000 people visiting those stands. The number of the exhibitors is actually over 300. So it is, very important, in this, especially Scandinavian market for young creative people.
I'd imagine it's lined with clothes everywhere and there's so much to choose from. But what's caught your eye this year in particular?
This time, two brands were actually very interesting for me. One is the label called Uniforms for the Dedicated. It's founded by a kind of creative collective of the Swedish people. They run a music label, they do film production, and they run a fashion label. And then actually 50% of their garments are coming from vegetable fiber. And it's actually quite funky, cool sort of utility garments. And then also they are making a new furniture label by collecting lots of furniture from his friends based in Archipelago in Sweden. And they're also launching a first standalone shop in Södermalm in Sweden in August. So that's quite exciting news. And I would love to sort of send a photographer, journalist, and then write about them.
Yeah, they'll sell. I'm guessing they'll sell all of their strands in that store.
Yeah, it is. It is quite an exciting area as well. Yes, obviously, like Sweden and Stockholm is one of the best, one of our favorite places in the world. So I just want to keep an eye on them. And the other label is from this town. It's called Rain.
Ah, now, is this the Parkers that are making a comeback?
Yes, it's Parkers, actually. Do you recognize the label?
I do, yes. They're, they're a divisive item, though, aren't they, the Parkers? You either love them or you hate them.
Yes, actually, this is quite interesting in the sense that they use very, very old-school Danish material. It's rainproof, but it's not breathable, such as, you know, like if you see Gore-Tex material, it's breathable and windproof and rainproof. But because this is such an old-school fabric, it's not breathable, which is rather interesting for me. And they made a kind of prototype collection last season, and it completely sold out. So they decided to launch the label properly, and then it's called Rains. And they make those, as you pointed out, they make beautiful parkas, raincoats, and then also the bags. And then they obviously Copenhagen is cyclist town, so they consider the bags for the cyclists as well. So if you get caught up in the rain while cycling, it's good to have those bags.
You're speaking about old school there, as a throwback to the 20s from Oregon, also at the shows this year.
Yes, it is. It's called a Dehen. It's like a very as you said, old school. They make a very old school like a style baseball jackets. I don't know if it makes sense in British English. If you go to like a baseball stadium, in the States, you wear those like a jacket.
Yeah, I imagine those stripy cuffs as well. Am I right? Is that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Stripy cuffs, ribs, and also wool body with leather sleeves, and it's quite colorful. And they, those are the kind of favorite items of the students in the States. And lots of Japanese fans are out there in the vintage market. Those jackets are used as a sort of good reference by the contemporary fashion designers. So, it was a great discovery to to be able to know those brands in Copenhagen. They don't really show anywhere else. So that's why Copenhagen is interesting for me.
And something even older as well, coming out of Germany, some bags that I hear you've fallen in love with.
Yeah, it is. It's called Sale Marshall. The brand has been around since 1896. It's all handmade in Germany, very colorful outdoor bags, and then sort of like quite really sort of hard utility type of like outdoor boots. It's kind of like it's similar to L.L. Bean, but it's more like solid in a way. I really like those products as well.
Takaharu Sato there, Monocle's fashion editor. Thank you ever so much for joining us. Now, with our Danish theme to get us going, we're going to go to a song now by a Danish artist. This is Efterklang, a Danish band, with The Modern Drift. Was Efterklang with The Modern Drift. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be hearing about Qatar Airways' latest venture, so do stay with us.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the design section, we take a closer look at charm and profile 10 companies around the world that are nailing it. We also kick back on the beach in New Zealand in Herbst Architect's latest creation.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Now, Qatar Airways has unveiled a new premium lounge at London's Heathrow Airport this week. It's located in Terminal 4 and is the airline's only dedicated lounge for first and business class travellers outside of its Doha hub. Now, we sent our Section E editor, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi, along to have a look around earlier today. He joins us in the studio now, along with Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Welcome, both of you.
Hi, Chris.
Santiago, firstly, what is the lounge like? I've heard very nice things about it.
Well, the lounge looks more like a hotel lounge, like a boutique hotel, rather than an airport facility. It's obviously sparkling because it's new. It opened last Friday. Despite the fact one would think it would be over the top and a lot of bling and gold.
Lots of gold.
It's actually not. It's very understated. It has a very clean design. I liked it very much.
It's interesting as well that, Christian, as you said in the intro as well, that they've gone for this. I mean, London, of course, is a very important, London-Doha, very important route. And they've made much of their lounge sort of pavilion that they have in Doha. And, of course, much has also been made about the fact that, the Qataris are going to be building a massive new airport as well and huge investments. But sometimes, you tend to see airlines actually putting sort of more effort into their points of connection rather than this sort of huge expenditure to a place which is the end of the line because they're not connecting anywhere from London. So it's interesting that they've gone for this. But I think, not unlike, with Emirates as well, across the field in Terminal 3, they're throwing everything at it because, all of these airlines having just, recently been in the Asia-Pacific region, whether it's Air New Zealand or it's Qantas, they're all sort of throwing up their hands because they're just those. Well, Emirates, Etihad, and Qatar are just really thumping a lot of the traditional legacy carriers.
It's a big race going on at the moment, and they're not just investing in the looks of their lounges, but they're expanding their routes as well.
Yeah, I mean, look at the order books for the planes, and Qatar Airways being case in point. Absolutely gunning for it, and we've seen series after series of record orders from Emirates, and Etihad, and so I think if you're sitting in Sydney and you're the CEO of Qantas, or New Zealand and a lot of these markets, which traditionally these kangaroo routes, which are so important. And it was really a monopoly between Qantas and British Airways, and then latterly sort of, Singapore jumped on the bus as well. But, these carriers, partly on price, they really want to be able to pull passengers through Abu Dhabi, Dubai and Doha.
How big a factor is the design of these lounges and enticing customers from another airline?
I don't even think Santiago, but I think people do make an active purchase. I mean, particularly when you have to connect. I think this is the one thing, at Heathrow, because, they're not bringing connecting passengers through. So there's a bit of a question mark as to how much people want to go to the airport early. I sometimes think, a premium passenger, no matter how much you like it, you're busy all day. I think you just want to get on the plane, sleep and go. But when you're connecting and you know that you've got 2 hours, I think it's hugely important. I think that's why, Cathay Pacific also unveiled an overhauled lounge in Hong Kong this week. And so I think that, there where you've got sort of 90 minutes, you might sort of make that an active part of your ticket purchase.
Yeah, I think it's a good place to be very, very calm. It was very tranquil, silent. That really surprised
me. Was it busy?
There were, I could count maybe like 20 or 30 people.
Right.
The place is 750 square meters and it can host up to 90 people at a time. Mm-hmm. But most people were like relaxing in big chairs that looked very comfortable.
I noticed pictures of these chairs.
No, you came back looking very well rested, Santiago.
I actually went straight for the delicatessen and the brasserie and the martini bar to try a bit of the food and the drinks.
And was it staffed? I mean, this is always the interesting thing as well, because I think, you know, you can spend all the great money you want on design, but you know, if you have to go make your own martini and there's no one there, but is it a full?
No. Actually, there are, I think it's 20 staff, and between them, they speak 10 different languages. So greeting you at the front door was a beautiful girl, Brazilian girl with an iPad, taking any different requests. At the martini bar, there were
How did you know she was Brazilian?
Sorry?
How did you know she was Brazilian?
Because her name was Clarissa, so I asked.
Okay,
yeah, let's chat with her.
A bit of Latin American flirtation there.
Very good.
How important is it to maintain the identity of the country from which the airline originates, but at the same time appeal to audiences, passengers from other countries as well? This looks like a fusion between London hotels, but with the Qatari
feel. Now that you say London hotels, the architects went to many five-star hotels here in London, and they also went to the Museum of Islamic Art in Doha to come up with this concept and for some inspiration. And as you say, it is a very luxurious space that they got from the hotels. But it has an Arabic feel to it. Mm. So you will see Arabic calligraphy on the walls and mosaics and fretwork decorating everything. So I think
the chairs look very
also Arabic. Yeah,
very ornate.
Yeah, I think that is though one of the you raise a good point. Is one of the challenges, I think, for, you know, for many of these airlines, because, you know, as you said, well, the expectation is going to be very bling, and that's, you know, it's something that sort of, you know, Emirates, it has played a large, you know, large part in that with a lot of their gold and their interiors, etc. You know, I do think though that it's been very hard for these sort of Gulf airlines to actually forge an identity, though, because, as you said, they have so many staff from different lands. Because, of course, you're not going to have, you know, you don't have Qataris really working for the airlines. Mm-hmm. You know, the population isn't even big enough, and you know, and most people who do service work, you know, come from overseas, so. You know, it's very hard to, when you don't have that human capital, you know, and there's sort of not a shared set of experiences, it's very hard for, I think, these airlines, you know, to define themselves. And so they have to, and that's the challenge for the design agencies, is to come up with a very specific signature for them.
And one that continues once they're on board the plane.
One would hope, yes.
Yeah. Hopefully, yeah.
So looking at Heathrow Airport as a hub, what does this lounge say about the importance of an investment of this scale in individual lounges by airlines?
Well, you know, there's no question that, you know, Heathrow is going to, it's going to be around a little bit longer. Of course, you know, we've been covering it. There's much talk about whether the Conservative government is going to go ahead, or at least, you know, they may not be in power by the time it's built, but will they push ahead with this new airport in the Thames Estuary? But it is crunch point for Heathrow. You have an airport which is completely, you know, it's at overcapacity. It only has two runways. It doesn't operate round the clock. And yet it has to sort of register that, is it still going to be in the game globally? And that's a huge issue. And, you know, nevertheless, though, I mean, London's an important market, you know, for those carriers. And, you know, I think given, you know, this, of course, being a key financial center, you know, Qatar wants to encourage as many, you know, passengers to fly through their hub.
They're actually inaugurating a fifth flight in late March to from London to Doha. They're operating four at the moment.
Santiago Toditi and Tyler Brulé, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's time for some music now. This is Stockholm by Quiet Nights Orchestra. That was Stockholm by Quiet Nights Orchestra. Our producer Katie pointed out that was quite apt to follow the lounge discussion. It was quite loungy in its feel. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be meeting some of our neighbours, asking whether French children are better behaved and asking whether eating meat should require a licence. But first, here's the news with Louise Banbury.
Thanks, Christian. Four people have been killed in Egypt on a second day of clashes triggered by the deaths of 74 people at Port Said football stadium on Wednesday. A demonstrator and an army officer were reported dead in Cairo, and two people were killed in the city of Suez. Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, says the Islamic Republic won't yield to international pressure to abandon its nuclear program. He also hinted at retaliation for sanctions aimed at Iran's oil exports, saying that attacking Iran would harm America. Kuwait's Islamist-led opposition made significant gains in the Gulf state's fourth parliamentary election in 6 years, with candidates taking as many as two-thirds of the assembly's 50 seats. Hungarian flag carrier Malev ceased operating after its planes were held overseas for unpaid debts. Several budget carriers announced an increase in their flights from Budapest Airport to plug the gap. Japan's Panasonic Corp has forecast a record annual loss of 7.75 billion euros for the year to March, which is much more than expected. Malaria kills more than 1.2 million people worldwide a year. That's nearly twice as many as previously thought, according to new research published in The Lancet today. The UN-backed War Crimes Tribunal in Cambodia ruled that the Khmer Rouge's prison chief should serve the rest of his life in jail. It extended a 19-year sentence handed down in July 2010. And Nepal's Maoist former rebels shed their camouflage uniforms and began leaving their camps today to join their families in a first step to their reintegration 5 years after the end of a civil war. And those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Louise. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. Well, French women have long been admired for their ability to seemingly eat what they want and still stay thin. Their secret was revealed in a popular book a few years ago. Now a new book is exploring the enviable way French children behave. It's called French Children Don't Throw Food. It examines the very different parenting style of the French. Earlier, I caught up with the book's author, Pamela Druckerman, an American living in Paris. I started by asking her what the main differences between French and Anglo parenting styles are.
I think if I had to summarize the difference overall, I think it's that French parents, and especially French mothers, don't assume that they have to give up their whole lives, body and soul, when their child arrives. They think that no one part of your life, not parenting, not work, not your relationship, should overwhelm the other parts. And I think in America and in Britain and in many other places, the parenting part, the motherhood part, really takes everything over. And so French women, when they have lives to themselves, they don't let guilt kind of creep in and take over.
Easier said than done, though, isn't it, Pamela? How do French parents avoid indulging their kids?
Well, they have a lot of faith in their kids and a lot of respect for their kids, and you can see that very much in the way they eat. You know, there's really no such thing as kids' food in France the way there is in the English-speaking world, you know, with all the chicken fingers and pizza and all that. You know, French kids eat what their parents eat, and that's starting from a very young age. And they eat at the same times that their parents eat. You know, they don't. There's one snack a day, and that's at 4 o'clock, and the rest of the time, French children don't snack. There isn't this sort of constant feeding on playgrounds and things that you see in the rest of the world. And the French parents have this tasting principle around food. You just have to taste a food many times. And it's the same thing for adults. We don't like unfamiliar foods either. So the French kind of genius about food is to repropose the same food sometimes dozens of times until the kid really likes to eat artichokes.
They will eventually like it, whether they like it or not.
And we do too. I mean, what the French really do, and their secret is not necessarily something mind-blowing. They don't reinvent the wheel. What they do is kind of clear away the clutter of all these competing parenting philosophies and just hone in on the one or two things that really do work. I'd say more than anything, it's sort of pragmatic parenting. There's not a lot of ideology about motherhood and about the way things should happen. It's just, you know, you want to get your kid to sleep through the night at 2 or 3 months old. This is the one thing you have to do. And it's sort of, the book is about my personal journey too, because I had three kids in France. And, you know, my struggle to kind of implement what I've learned, these French secrets I've learned on my own poor unsuspecting children.
You have to be a good disciplinarian though, don't you? And I'm assuming you have to start when they're at an early age.
Well, you know, I don't think it's ever too late to start believing that you ought to be the one in charge. I mean, it's a very simple concept. The French say, c'est moi qui décide, it's me who decides. And sometimes they have to repeat it to kind of remind themselves. But I think it's this conviction that the French have that really, gives them their authority and makes their children actually listen to them. The French idea is that you're very firm about certain key things, but you actually give kids a lot of freedom about everything else. And it's that sort of cocktail. And one of the things they're very strict about is, of all things, politeness. It's you have to say please and thank you. But in French, there are two other magic words, bonjour and au revoir, hello and goodbye. And even little kids must say hello. And parents say not only is this just to be polite, it rescues children from being selfish. It takes them out of their little bubble and makes them realize there are other people in the world and kind of humanizes them.
Aside from persistence, Pamela, and a dogged determination to make your kids try something new or something old for that matter, how else can you get your kids to try new foods?
What French parents do, I found, is make the kids part of the eating process, from shopping to cooking. I mean, it took me a while to figure out what French parents were actually doing because they don't know because they all sort of do the same thing. But every time I visited a French family on a Saturday, they would serve a cake that they'd made that morning. And actually, the kids are very involved in making this cake, and it's a lesson also for the kids in patience and learning how to sort of, follow a sequence and not eat all the batter before the cake goes in, and then waiting to eat the cake until the 4 o'clock snack. So I think it's very much involving the kids, making it fun, not talking about vegetables as these sort of vitamin delivery devices, but, being excited about the flavor of each food and treating, getting to like carrots and getting to like celery as a kind of adventure.
Can the Anglo cultures adopt some of these techniques, or do the messages from food companies make that impossible?
I think every parent gets to make choices for himself and herself, and a lot of the French techniques are not about, buying particular products or making your kid love camembert. It's just it's about an approach to parenting. It's a very, in some ways, it's about, having more authority over your kid, but it's also about giving your kid more credit to be able to handle things on his own, to not need constant praise, to not need to be constantly stimulated by you. And, I think the wisest thing that French parents told me is, if a child is playing happily and is absorbed in something, just leave him alone. That's one of the great pleasures of life and the great skills of life, is to be able to keep yourself occupied. And that's not that you can do that, whichever nation you live in.
And reward good behavior with a nice piece of camembert, perhaps.
Absolutely.
That was Pamela Druckerman, the author of French Children Don't Throw Food, talking to me earlier. You're listening to Midori House, where it's now time for a bit more music. Keeping it French, this is Yel and Kavatu.
Ils se croisent tous les jours comme un couple en amour. Elle lui sourit légèrement avec un tas d'arrière-pensées. Regarde toujours où il va, ce qu'il fait dans son rétroviseur. Mais elle n'a jamais.
That was Yael with Kever 2. Soon we'll be hearing from one of our own neighbours, so stay with us.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tire.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we can make it a shining jewel, and we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24.
It's coming up to 2:15 the hour here in London. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Every week on this programme, we like to go into our local area and talk to some small business owners who make up the fabric of our colourful neighbourhood. Today we went to meet the owner of James Taylor and Son, a bespoke shoemaker's just around the corner from Midori House.
My name's Steve Robinson, and I own this company called James Taylor & Son.
It's a specialist orthopedic shoemaker. It's been running for over 150 years in London, and it specializes in making bespoke shoes for people with foot problems. I took over the business only in August of last year. It's been the same family before that for 80 years, a family called Schweiger, who came over from Germany to take over the original James Taylor and Son, and they brought with them some new ideas on orthopedic shoemaking from Germany. In a way, that's similar to what I'm doing now. I brought in new technology from Britain and Germany to modernise this business. It's part of the West End shoemaking tradition. We're slightly on the fringes of the West End, being in Marylebone. It's where there has traditionally been a lot of shoemaking and bespoke tailoring, and you can still find some other bespoke tailoring shops in this area, as I think you know. So, yes, historically, it's been around here, and that's where many of our customers live or can easily get to, so it's a very good location. Well, the big draw to James Taylor is bespoke shoes for problem feet. So the big problem in Britain in particular, and it's also in the world like America, is that you can't get good orthopedic shoes on the NHS, for example. Quality is very poor, the fit is very poor, and indeed 70% of NHS orthopedic shoes are never actually worn. It's quite extraordinary. So people give up on that, and if they have the money, they can come to us and they can get a really nice pair of bespoke orthopedic shoes made. We guarantee they'll fit. We'll take as long as it takes to make them fit. We use the highest quality materials. And so, you know, that's our main sort of attraction, if you like. Beginning of this year has been brilliant, and I think this is the best month we've had in decades, looking back. I can't explain that, really, but I suppose if you have enough money to buy a decent pair of shoes, perhaps those people are less affected by the crisis than others. But at the moment, the business is doing very well, yeah, which is fine. If you've got a problem feet, you can't get into a standard footwear, and you're in constant pain if you do, then there's an enormous incentive to have bespoke shoes made, and people, I think, will find the money to do that. They don't, in a way, have a choice. You know, it's a fairly fixed market, I think. Everything is made here in our London, you know, Marylebone premises. So behind the shop and underneath the shop, we have workshops, and we have traditional craftsmen who cut everything by hand. You know, the leather's all hand-stitched and so on. The only thing that has changed recently is that we now have a very clever 3D scanning system installed in the shop, which allows us to capture the foot really accurately, and we use CAD-CAM now to actually design our shoe lasts digitally. They're then milled in Beech, and then they go through the sort of traditional process for manufacturing, but we get a much higher level of accuracy of fit, which is, you know, it's good for customers and obviously good for us.
That was Steve Robinson from our local bespoke shoe service, James Taylor and Son. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, an unusual exhibition has opened recently in The Hague, which features, amongst other things, a black market pudding. It's a traditional British dish known otherwise as a blood sausage, but this type is made with the blood of living animals. While it might sound a bit macabre, the hope is that it will actually soon be a product that can be bought online. It's part of a wider UK-based campaign called the Meat Licence Proposal. It's a draft piece of legislation which would see all meat eaters applying for a licence before they could satisfy their appetites for animals. It also proposes a practical test, the killing of a live animal. Well, John O'Shea, who started the campaign, joins us now on the line. Welcome, John.
Hello there, Christian.
Now, first question that I'm sure many people would like to ask is, why did you want to create this proposal?
Well, I suppose it built on various kind of anxieties over several years. I'm somebody who's grown up in the UK, which is, as I suppose people internationally would know, a country of animal lovers. At the same time, when we go to our supermarkets, the products there, the meat products, are very much packaged in a way which separates those meat products from the process, which is, of course, animal slaughter. So over a period of time, it seemed to me that
maybe some kind of law which would reconnect those two aspects of culture might be a positive thing.
Can you not be an animal lover and a meat lover, though?
I'm sure that you can, yes. Yes, I'm sure that you can.
How would this plan work then, John? You'd kill one animal each time, or how long would that one kill last you for?
Yeah, these are really interesting questions. I suppose that the proposal itself is in development, and what we're hoping to do is to develop a law which would allow people to engage with the act of killing. Now, if it's practical that people, for instance, take part in slaughter, obtain their license, and that license is valid for a period of several years, then I guess that is how it would work.
What would this do? Curb the consumption of meat eating, or just, as you say, reconnect the concept of killing the animal rather than, as you say, in that cellophane on the shelf? There's no thought that goes into it when you buy it in the present sense.
Yeah, I think that's quite important to point out. The law isn't in any way intended to curb meat eating. It's simply a type of law which would facilitate people in a more active engagement with the products that they're consuming.
Now, you're an artist by trade. What made you get involved in this, and what made you create this black market sausage?
Okay, yeah. Well, I suppose as an artist, yeah, I'm not a lawmaker, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a politician. But I think for the whole of the 20th century and now in the 21st century, artists have been renowned for getting involved in perhaps fields where you wouldn't expect. You know, artists got involved in making videos, in developing things on the internet. And so I became quite interested in getting involved in law as a medium that maybe could be explored quite creatively. And as regards the black market pudding, since I initiated the meat license proposal, I myself haven't consumed any meat. And one of the things that kept coming up from people in our consultations was that people would try to find a way around this law. And so what I've been interested in is developing a product which, in a sense, fits between consuming meat, but at the same time not killing animals.
I don't suppose you've given much thought to the concepts proposed by scientists now, where you can grow meat in a petri dish without even harming an animal.
Well, as it happens, I'm actively involved in tissue culture work. I'm currently in residence in a clinical engineering department working with tissue culture. What I would say is there's a lot of hyperbole about the possibilities of culturing meat in a laboratory. But the processes involved in feeding those cells involve the slaughter of animals to produce special serums for growing that meat. So I think the notion of any kind of victimless meat, I think, is a nonsense.
What sort of reception have you received from this proposal? Are people taking it seriously as a legitimate piece of law?
Well, I've received mixed responses. I met with a lot of people in Manchester in the north of England and explained to them the basic premise of the law, that people who are comfortable with eating meat should also be comfortable with killing animals. And a lot of people were a little bit shocked by that. But I think that if we're going to consume products, and that's what we do, then I think perhaps we should have a little bit more awareness and involvement in where those products come from.
Okay, if we look at teaching people the idea of killing the animal before you eat it, how would it work logistically, John? Would you have testing centres? How could you, if everybody was required to do this, this would be a nightmare to put in place in practice, wouldn't it?
I think it would be difficult in terms of bureaucracy and logistics, but I think that we probably do a lot more complex things as regards licensing and controlling substances already. If you think about something like the vehicle MOT system, which we have here in the UK, which is an annual procedure for checking that your vehicle is suitable for the road, similarly, people could attend a slaughterhouse and go through this procedure. I think the one thing that would stand in the way at the moment, which is probably the area we're going to look at first, is the nature of slaughterhouses in the UK. These are typically private enterprises where, as a member of the public, you would not be permitted to enter under any circumstances.
And who would enforce the licensing and who would check that you were entitled to buy meat in a shop?
Well, the way that licensing typically works for a lot of things in the UK now is that rather than the police necessarily policing it, I would imagine perhaps a private body might do that.
Obviously, different animals or different species, there's an element of levels of severity, isn't there? Slaughtering a cow is very different to going to fish in a lake. And you've suggested that there are different choices in the type of animal or creature that you kill to earn your license. Surely everybody would just choose to go fishing.
Yeah, well, that is an issue. And I think a tiered system would make sense. I mean, if you think about the way that animals are already classified internationally, typically we have animals which are classed as pets and animals which are classed as for meat, for consumption. And I think it would be necessary to introduce some level of classification, whether that was that you had different tiers of licensing where if you catch a fish, then perhaps you're entitled to seafood. Maybe if you kill a chicken, then that entitles you to a kind of poultry tier. I mean, for some reason, and I don't really know quite why it is, but as an animal gets bigger, I think people become more uncomfortable with the idea of killing the animal.
I think you're right there, John. We must leave it there as we've run out of time, but that was a very interesting talk. John O'Shea, thank you very much for joining us. Well, we are out of time for this Friday's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Katie Bilboa, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. In 3 hours, it's time for the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 hours London time with Tom Burgess-Watson and Andrew Muller. We'll be getting the latest from the Munich Security Conference. I'll be back on Midori House at the same time on Monday. But for now, it's goodbye from me and have a great weekend wherever you are. Headlines are next right here on Monocle 24. But before we go, no other song I don't think would be as apt after that last discussion with John. To play us out is Gladys Knight and License to Kill.